hear. I don't hear me.
I hear you, Robin.
You do?
I do.
Oh, great.
So we're going to get started with the show. We got caught unawares there for just a moment, but we're back with you. Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we'll expound on the virtues of a favorite backyard fruit, papaya, wrap up our month-long focus on soil building and management, and take a fresh plunge into high-quality, fully matured, brimming with life compost. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with our generous underwriters.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda Garden and Lawn Equipment and also Echo Power Equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design, complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
And thank you so much to our wonderful underwriters and our wonderful listeners. We're so grateful. We've just come out of the Spring Fund Drive. We did super great. Thanks to everyone. We topped the $60,000 mark, and we're just really super proud, and we want to give a shout-out to some very special people to us who donated during the course of our show.
Yes, thank you so much for donating specifically to In the Garden on the Farm, Laurel from Kilauea, Larry from Lawai, Karen from Waimea, Danny from Kilauea, Gabrielle and Rob from Kapa'a, Baba from Kilauea, Chris from Hanalei, Uncle Lindsay from Kapa'a, Laura from Kilauea, and Patricia from Anahola.
Thank you all, and we know that other of our listeners who generously donated listen to multiple shows and like to spread the love around, so we know that even more folks did actually make the effort to donate, and we just thank you one and all for helping us out. All the people who signed up as wave riders, it really was a very successful fund drive, and we're super grateful to you.
Yes, we are.
And we've got a great show today. We're going to get started in with our celestial session. We like to look to the heavenly skies above for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other farming and gardening activities. And we will begin, as we do, with a look to the Hawaiian moon phase happening out there. Tonight, the Hawaiian moon phase, thanks to the Hanalei Watershed Hui in their Hanalei Moon and Tide calendar for this reading, as well as the U.S. Naval Observatory for their information on the movements of the heavenly bodies. Tonight's Hawaiian moon will be Ole Ku Kolu, and Ole Ku Kolu will rise over Kauai at 2:32 p.m. this afternoon, not tonight. She'll reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 8:31 p.m., and she'll set at 2:37 a.m. tomorrow morning. This is the waxing moon. We're approaching the full moon now. 70% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated. We experienced the first quarter moon on Monday, a couple days ago. And Ole Ku Kolu is the third of four Ole moons in the first week of the Hawaiian moon month. Planting recommendations, well, collectively, the Ole nights were called Na Ole. They were considered unlucky for fishing, planting, or beginning any important activity because ole also means not, without, lacking, to deny, zero, nothing, not, negative, nothingness, or nobody. And a olelo no eau is known as, or a Hawaiian proverb or saying, one of them is, ea kako I na ole, which means, here we are at the ole nights. But the hidden meaning of that, that's the literal translation, but what it means is a time of poor luck during the ole nights. Well, hopefully we don't have to have poor luck two times a month, because we have ole moons in the waxing and the waning periods, four on the front end, three on the tail end of the moon. And certainly we can be lucky with lots of other things if it's not planting.
And they tend to hover around the quarter moons. Is that right, Paul?
They do indeed. Yeah. Yes. And so there is some influences going on there. But we shall deepen our experience of that. And I've just lost some more information. I've got some special information about the sun that I'll share in a bit, but we'll go to Robin and her sharing first on the biodynamic calendar.
Yes, in the biodynamic look at things, the moon is in its descending phase now, so it is planting time. The energies of the plant are moving downward towards the earth. So Wednesday through Saturday, the moon will be in its nice long stay in the constellation of Virgo, an earth sign, making it a great time to work with our root plants. So planting recommendations there would be root crops like carrots, beets. You'd probably squeeze a quick crop of radishes in before the weather gets too hot. Sunday, the moon will be in Libra, an air sign, making it time to work with our flowering plants. And so we have a chance to plant some of those beautiful summer flowers that we love so very much. And that will happen on Sunday. Monday and Tuesday next, the moon will be in Scorpio, a water sign, making it a good time to work with our leafy plants. So we've got some time to plant some of those summer greens that we like so much. I found mustards to do pretty well in the heat, Asian greens, and even certain kales can really rock out in the summer months as long as we keep them well watered and happy.
Awesome. Well, we're just getting back up and running here, but I can tell you from memory even that we're going to be experiencing a really special phenomenon coming up, and it happens two times a year here in the subtropics and the tropics, and that is actually a time where the sun is exactly overhead. This phenomenon does not occur in the temperate areas of the world. It gets to its highest point, but it's not really right overhead. And so this special phenomenon means that during this time period, there is no shadow cast. So if you were standing next to a flagpole in the full sun, you would see zero shadow anywhere around it. So that's a pretty cool phenomenon. And it's happening here coming up on, I believe it's Sunday. I'm just pulling up my information once again. It's going to take me a moment to pull it up, thanks to the Bishop Museum for letting us know. And it does depend on your latitude, even down to a fine degree of detail. So Kaneohe, Oahu, is experiencing it today at around 12:30 p.m. We'll experience it in Lihue. It was the reference city or town on Kauai, and that's going to be coming up this Sunday, the 31st, around 12:30. I'll get that exact timing coming up soon.
Well, you know, it seems to me like this might be the time of year we want to break out some sunblock. In that case, that sounds kind of scorching when I think about it.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, it's really crept up on us. But interesting that it's not correlated with the solstice. That
yes.
We're actually passing that point of the sun being directly overhead. And interesting like that.
And what is the name of this special event? Did it have a name?
Well, it does, and I think it's called the Lahaina Moon, which was actually not a traditional name, but it was there's more of a story at bishopmuseum.org. If you go to their observatory webpage, they have a story about how the name was actually derived, and it was more of a modern, they held a contest on actually naming this phenomenon, and there's some reference to it in ancient texts, but it's not exactly correlated with this exactly overhead period, but that there was a significant amount of mana with the sun being directly overhead. And just trying to get back to that information on my computer, which just crashed. So it's coming up, but for now, let's instead, rather than waiting, because this is live radio.
Yes, indeed. Let's take a peek in the backyard and talk about a wonderfully loved fruit from most people's backyards, and that would be papaya. So typically when I do a kitchen garden segment, it's usually about what's really going off in my garden. I've got so much of it that I'm processing it like crazy and I have it on the brain. But this time it's just a longing because I don't have any papayas growing in my yard right now. And I sure wish I did when I think about all the great things about them. Like they have more vitamin C than an orange or a lemon. They're really rich in vitamin A, beta-carotene, lutein, B-complex vitamins, potassium, calcium. We all know the fruits are delicious, but the seeds themselves also contain anti-inflammatory compounds, anti-parasitic compounds, and they're used for stomach ache and ringworm. I just really love cooking with green papaya. It's one of my favorite things. We use it as a vegetable quite often in our soups and stews. And in my research, I did find that raw green papaya does contain a latex, a sap, that does have some toxic type qualities to it. So although I've enjoyed my fair share of green papaya salad, it seems like we want to keep that to a minimum. Not that a little bit is going to hurt you, but too much of those particular compounds that are in that latex are not necessarily good for us.
I wonder if that's a good reason to move more toward using what I was taught was called the blush papaya, where it's still firm like a green papaya, but it's started to turn pink, and maybe some of those toxic chemicals have been sorted out in
the
mix. Yes,
I believe that is the case. But of course, cooking the all green ones and the green fleshed ones dissipates any of those chemicals get cooked out by heat. So basically, yeah, vegetable and soup stews, curries with the hard, immature fruits. Ripe fruits are great just for fresh eating, as we know. Friend of mine, Felicia, fellow programmer here, taught me to empty out lilikois or passion fruit into the cavity of the papaya once I take the seeds of the papaya out. And I just can't seem to get enough of that. But eating, juicing, papaya salsa, and as a vegetable, I know some of the nicer restaurants I've been to, they're serving a ripe papaya with alongside fish, so you can also eat that as a savory and not just as a sweet, fruity treat.
And purported, like you said, to be valuable as a medicinal plant for expelling worms from the gastrointestinal tract, as well. A tea made from the leaf is reported to be useful for combating certain kinds of cancer. Not used it personally, but it was requested of me to collect papaya leaves at one time for someone who was drying the leaves and sending it to a family member back in North America. So
yeah. Now this tree can proliferate simply out of our compost piles if left unattended, as we throw away the fruits. But cultivating them in the backyard, really easy. I sure wish I would have done that sooner. I'm finding in my garden, at least, I'm really getting about 2 good years of production of lots of fruiting, maybe a third if I'm really treating the plants nice. But they are not technically a tree at all. They are a plant. They're considered an herbaceous plant, so they don't have the long-term staying power as some of our other fruit trees that we might want to talk about. So really keeping that production up, requires plenty of fertilizer and plenty of water, although not too much because they can be sensitive to fungal type infections too, which are exacerbated by too much water. But once you get those going, you see those stout trunks and lots of fruit lining up the stem there. I start salivating.
Well, I'm excited to be harvesting more out of the food forest. The production certainly seems to be speeding up, and I don't know if it's the warmth of the sun that's causing the fruit to ripen now, or if it's just more metabolic activity in the soil, but the papayas certainly seem to be turning the corner. They were pretty sluggish in the wintertime, and they definitely seem to be pumping out the fruit.
You know, I noticed that too, Paul. The green ones will hang on those plants through the cool months and really don't want to ripen unless I pick one off the plant. And then, you know, probably picking it a little too young, it never really does flavor out or produce all those sugars that it does when it gets to ripen on the tree, of course. But I've always thought it was the sun, too, that the warm weather that helps ripen them. But this is the time of year, and I really got to keep saying it. I really wish I would have been on it and planted some about 6 months ago.
Shoots. Well, no time like the present. And as we'll discuss starting next week about planting, transplanting, direct seeding, papaya is a crop that's known to perform very well, from my personal experience, too, as a direct seeded crop. So, like you said, they pop out of the compost pile, and maybe we might assume that most of our listeners already know that a lot of the papayas that we would buy in the regular grocery store are GMO. And a lot of the reason that the pollen is being spread is because people have thrown the papaya seeds out into their compost or just out the window. And now we have GMO plants that weren't intentionally planted by a farmer, but they are what is popping up in people's backyards. So good idea to start with something organic. I think the easiest way really is just go to the organic section of the, you know, grocery store, or go to a health store and get an organic papaya. Papayas sourced from the island of Molokai are all GMO-free, is what I've been taught by an extension agent, our good buddy Glenn Tevis over there. So that would be a good source as well. And we look forward to having certified organic non-GMO seeds at the seed bank. Currently, we don't have anything that's guaranteed to be that, but definitely a wide variety. A lot of talk about the exotica variety, but the ones I've seen growing on Kauai just don't seem to like our soils or something. The plants get the fruit on them, but the leaves look incredibly stressed and disease, like sick. So lots of different varieties out there, and enjoy.
Yeah, there is another option too. If you do have some come up out of your compost, I'm actually pretty fussy about which papaya seeds even get put in my compost, because I know about their propensity to want to sprout up. But if that happens to you and you're curious and it's like a nice strong tree and you don't really want to take it out, you can have those trees tested for GMOs at the
Agricultural Diagnostic Service Center.
Thank you, Paul. At UH over there in Honolulu. And you can find out more about that from our extension agents. And I'll just give you the hot tip. What they really want is a very young leaf, like a 2-inch leaf. So one of the newest leaves that's growing out of the plant. Not a larger old leaf. They want a brand new leaf, and the turnaround for the test was pretty quick. I think within 10 days I had results on the tests I had done.
Cool. We want to let you know you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We're going to jump into some notable news. We have a special guest coming into studio shortly after that. So great show. Please stay tuned with us, and we think you'll be glad you did. We've got some good news coming out of Oahu and the College of Tropical Agriculture that our friend, we've had her on the show before, really appreciate the work she's doing, the spirit she brings to it. Kunhui Wang has been awarded a pretty substantial grant for sustainable pest management approaches for high tunnels greenhouse production in the tropics. And Dr. Wang is always looking at ways in which we can avoid using pesticides, avoid continuing to contaminate the soil. And if we're growing in greenhouses, if we're growing in screen houses that exclude the pests that otherwise might be sprayed with pesticides out in the field, it could mean an elimination of that cultural practice for certain farmers. So they're actually going to be doing some scientific research and looking at the profitability difference of building a screen house and eliminating the pest problem for various crops with that method as compared with using pesticides. And they're going to roll out all the information in the great way that they do at UH with publications. They'll do workshops and pretty cool. We definitely have some pretty significant pest issues in the open field environment that makes some crops just impossible to grow, or many of them very challenging. And while I like the idea of just that natural system, sometimes resorting to an artificial structure, if you will, if it can help eliminate the poisons, sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, us, Paul, I speak for you and I, we're small gardeners. You know, we're not farming for profit necessarily. So we get to grow just a few of this and a few of that. But if you're looking to make some money off of the crop, you have to look at ways that you can grow it in a way. And organic, of course, is bringing in more money in the marketplace now. So people want to go that way. And, you know, being able to grow out a huge field of one crop without having to use any kind of pesticides is sure is a trick. So that's great research that Dr. Wang is doing. Yeah. Hopefully she'll make some headway. And for those folks who do grow their vegetables for profit, we look for some great innovations coming up soon.
Truly. Another story, this one from mongabay.com. Entitled Consumer Choice Shade Grown Coffee and Cocoa Good for Birds, Farmers, and Ecosystems. So this is based on a new study published by the Journal of Ornithology, and the researcher was looking at how tropical birds interact with agricultural habitats to better understand their ecology, the ecosystem services they provide, and conservation. The researcher, whose name was too complicated with too many symbols that I didn't know how to pronounce. He seemed to be from a Norwegian or a Scandinavian country, I should say. At any rate, he compared over 6,000 bird species that live in native forests, agroforests, and open farmland. And it turns out that agroforests promote and maintain way more bird life than open farmland do. There's a wider variety of bird types living in the tree canopy, and they are providing far greater ecosystem services than the birds that live in open farmland. Agroforests also support more pollinator and insect-eating species, whereas the open cropland supports birds that damage grain crops. So the grain-eating birds that make growing rice so difficult here and other grains are supported by this open farmland. So if we're moving toward agroforests, we can move toward supporting bird species that are more conducive to our production methods. Primary forests, so not agricultural forests, near cropland appear to support more insectivorous bird species and help reducing the need for pesticides as well. Now, research was not specific to Hawaii, where our ecosystems are quite different, looking at really tropical farms throughout the tropical world, many, many different systems. So these are sort of broad generalities. And then the researcher finally said, although agroforestry is better than open farmland in terms of supporting a diversity of birds that are more helpful to support ecosystem services and the farmer, at the end of the day, intact tropical forests is the only suitable habitat for thousands of bird species that would otherwise not have a habitat. So essentially, the message there is, don't convert a bunch of native forest into agroforest and think that all of the biodiversity in it is going to be maintained. That's obviously not the case.
Sure. Well, you know, I picked up some of those wonderful shade-grown coffee beans when I visited the Big Island about a month ago or so. The Hamakua Coast has got shade-grown coffee that is... I'm not even really a coffee drinker, and boy, that stuff was good.
Mm. It is delicious. Delicious. We did have a caller who'd like to know the proper protocol for drying organic papaya seed that he has produced so he can donate them to the seed bank. Okay, I'm personally invested in this now. So, basically, the papaya seed, each and every papaya seed has a pouch on the outside of it with some liquid in there. And if that is allowed to dry on the seed, it can put the seed into a greater state of dormancy. So the best thing to do, work with your fresh papaya seed, roll those papaya seeds that are still in the membrane out onto a surface. It's really helpful to use a tea towel. And then just mash them. You can do it between paper. You can do it between newspaper if that's what you have handy. But basically, you're pushing down firmly enough on the seed to pop open those little pouches. And as you roll them back and forth across the surface of a tabletop, you'll see that the seeds are separating from all of those little membranes. And just do that. You may need to change your towel or your newspaper a few times. And then always good to give them a bit of a rinse because it was in moisture anyway. Get some of those sugars away that could ferment or otherwise cause other things to grow on the seed. Air dry them, and then it's good to give them a deeper level of drying. We do have tools and techniques at the Kauai Community Seed Bank as well. We'd love to demonstrate and show you how. So if the caller's listening, give us a call, 652-4118, and we'd be happy to take you further down the road. Dried papaya seed germinates fairly well, but it's going to germinate better, as does all seed, when it is fresh. So, you know, best to sow it straight away if you can, but it's great to have them stored up for your use whenever you're around to use them. That's all I know.
Sounds great.
We want to invite our special guest onto air now. We're joined in the studio by our good buddy, Amigo Bob. He's back on island. He's
woo-hoo!
Come. He's coming and he's bringing... 40 years of multiple crop organic farming experience, everything from the backyard garden to farms tens of thousands of acres in size. I can't imagine, I can't even imagine that. But it's super great to have his experience here. He's actually been brought here to share his experience, and he's been generous enough to join us on air and share his experience with the whole community. So, Bob, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Paul. I'm honored to be here.
Yay.
So how's it been?
It's been 14 months since I was here last, and it flew by in an eyelash, and just boom, which is good.
Yes.
The busiest and most productive parts of my life, combined with some of the most challenging, which is probably, for most people, that's normal.
Yes.
Agriculture is really exciting and stimulating. I give it up every day in my work that, despite having done all what I've done, I don't know hardly anything yet. It's just learning. You know, every day is an opportunity for learning in agriculture.
What's the most recent thing that comes to mind to you that you learned that you went, oh, my God, I can't believe I didn't know that?
I learned a better way to prune a peach tree from a friend of mine, a technique I'd never seen before. And it's hard to describe it, but it's a combination of what's known as a modified leader and an open vase, but a little more aggressive pruning, but also mm-hmm. keeping the fruit low enough to be able to pick more of it from the ground,
mm-hmm.
which could be applied to any stone fruit, not necessarily applicable here in Kauai, but in where I work a lot. So that was like, oh, well, I'd seen pictures of that, but to actually have someone walk me through it and have me rethink, oh, I could see how I could do this better, and that's why I'm going to actually take some of my young baby trees and prune them that way and see what I learned from that.
Nice.
But I really do. I have the luxury of working on some of the world's best farmers. I learn from them as much as I teach. And the best farmers I know are the best observers. It's clearly what separates the okay or average farmer from the best are the ones that are the best observers. And what they've learned to do is observe and adopt, because nature's constantly evolving. You made a comment earlier as I was driving and listening about papaya and how they're ripening faster. Well, there's a few other pieces here. One is just the day length. As the days get longer, there's more photosynthesis, and when there's more photosynthesis, the plant makes more interchange with sunlight and nutrients and water and carbohydrate production, but also so do all the microorganisms. As a longer day length, they keep working longer because the soil temperature and the air and the moisture are appropriate. So that's why a lot of times we get this flush of growth in May and June or ripening, and then kind of you turn the corner and July, it starts to slow down again, and it gets really slow when you get to December on day length. Even if it's warm,
right,
day length is still not there. And so just to give you an example of that, trying to manage fertility with insect pests, this is the time of the year where, given a reasonable environment, the microbiology is most active releasing its nutrients, and particularly calcium or nitrogen. You need to talk? No. Talk louder?
Yeah.
Speak up?
Speak up.
I'm in the chill mood for being here, so it'll be a little more spoken louder. Thank you. So this is the time of year where biology is releasing, is breaking down the organic matter very rapidly and releasing its nutrients that are bound up both in the organic matter and all those microbes that live and die and live and die. Some of them by only hours, they become food for everybody else. This speeds up when the soil temperatures get up and the day length gets long and moisture's there, a perfect environment for lots of biology. Well, a common phenomenon happens with crops is oftentimes farmers, gardeners as well, don't see that that's a change seasonally, and they want to do the same exact practices fertilization-wise as they would in the winter. Mm-hmm. Well, in the winter, things go very slow, and the response is very inefficient, and biology is slowed down, and so you actually have to give it a little more boost in the winter than right now. And I just came from a field, to give you an example, cauliflower and salinas. Look, there's a very great place to grow cauliflower, one of the best in the world. But we had to learn how to unfertilize that cauliflower in the spring because there's so much biology releasing all the nitrogen that if we don't, we get a lot of aphids. Aphids love plants that are high in nitrogen and succulent. They love that environment. So instead of doing fertilization in spring, we're relying more on the soil biology, which includes more compost tea, less actual nutrients. That way we get a nice crop with less bugs. But as soon as we turn that corner in July and August, I go, oh, the biology is slowing down. And now we have to pay attention again to keeping a little bit of supplementation. I just use that as an example how things, the best farmers I know are the best observers. And you every single day you learn something. And my very best all-time clients of all time are strawberry farmers. I don't know why they're so amazing, but they have the ability to see things I cannot see. And Cokes, since I've worked in strawberries, you know, a flat of strawberries has like, you know, 3 pounds, you know, one of those things, baskets, a box, cardboard box full of baskets. Good yield back in the 80s was, for organic farm, was 4,000 of those flats on an acre. Now the good ones are getting 8,500 and 9,000 flats. In 30 years, we've doubled the production.
Incredible.
They've doubled it because they're just getting better and better at doing it. They really observe. So I'm out there in the field, and they're saying, I think we should irrigate for 20 minutes, but not until the wind picks up a little. I'm like, how do you know that? Because they were on those plants every single day.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's about observing, and I just realize we're all still observers, and I'm 45 years into this, and I'm still constantly observing. Walking around on Waikoa today, it's like, oh, what do I see today? It's different than yesterday.
Yeah, it's a snapshot. You know, I've actually observed the same seasonal phenomenon with my plants, and seeing that I have to kind of pull back on the fertilizer because those aphids are like the thorn in the lion's toe. You know, yes. As soon as you know your soil's a little too hot when you see them sort of hovering around the plants, you know, it's like, uh-oh,
and the leaf
time
liners
to, time
and the
to
white
back
flies,
off a little bit.
They all like that succulent tissue.
Yeah, they sure do. Well, today,
that's
amigo,
not why I came in to talk.
Though. Yeah, well, today we're wrapping up a month. We talked about soil building and management,
yes. And
we're kind of more on the management ticket today. And our main focus is sanitation, cover cropping, and fallow or resting.
And taking a rest.
Yeah, what's that, right? We all need that once in a while, and so do our soils. But wondered where you might like to chime in on any of those topics.
Boy, they all are really important, and they all tie together. It's about giving the soil the opportunity to regenerate itself and rehabilitate itself and to take a break from the various things. So fallow and crop rotation are in that world. What was the three things you said? One more time.
Sanitation,
yes.
Cover cropping
and fallow.
Fallow.
Okay. So fallow, I'll start with that one. Because you can think of fallow as, just left there, did nothing. That's one approach. And that actually gives the soil a chance to heal. You're not extracting, you're not cultivating, you're not watering, you're not tromping on it. You're basically letting nature take time to heal itself. That is helpful. And even if you do nothing, that's sometimes better than doing too much. So a basic practice has been done since the beginning of agriculture and all too often gets forgotten, is to give the soil a rest, that period of fallow. So fallow just means nothing's happening in the moment. Now, why are you doing that? Well, biology has a chance to take a break, breaks down the organic matter, structure improves, earthworms have a place to migrate through, water gets in. All those are opportunities that happen naturally if we don't interfere. Mm-hmm. Somehow we think we should interfere all the time in growing things. It's sort of our natures. There's kind of two groups of people maybe that are the ones that are way interfering a lot in nature and want to make things happen. And then there's the kind of more, I just observe it.
Well, sure. It's a matter of I grew this.
Yes.
Or it grew itself. Kind of
yes.
Mindset there, right?
Yes.
Well, when we talk about fallow or rest, I mean, in a high production system, how much time are we talking about? I mean, I know that's kind of hard to pinpoint.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's actually how much issues do you have. If things are growing lushfully and you're happy and the diseases and the weeds aren't driving you nuts, why are that so critical? On the other hand, if you're having problems with nematodes or stunted growth or weeds that are out of control, then maybe there needs to be some more time taken to actually give the soil a chance to heal. I think a good rule of thumb is if you can get a period in every year where that soil gets a chance to heal, which might only be 30 or 40 days, which might be an opportunity to grow a cover crop. So you could actually do fallowing, that is, give the soil a chance to heal and also still grow a little something for that soil. So good crop around here most year round is buckwheat. Easy to grow. Except in the coldest weather, it grows rapidly. 30, 45 days, it's done its job. Gave your ground a little bit of a rest. You can eat that. It's a wonderful crop to eat. High in phosphorus and calcium and iron. The bees love it. Honeybees and native bees all go crazy on it. And it picks up an unavailable phosphorus out of the soil, a form that other plants can't absorb. So it cycles up. The phosphorus is real deficient on most of this island naturally, low phosphorus. So you kind of do a whole bunch of things. Oh, and by the way, you give the ground a break. It's just kind of grow, and you're not messing with it. So that's a fallow approach. You could have a longer one if you have more time. And I notice a lot of gardens, even in intensive gardens, have quite a bit of period of time when they're not all being used. So another piece of that might be growing a legume in rotation. Maybe most everyone is searching for more forms of nitrogen to keep their crop lush. Well, legumes do it naturally, in place, as part of fallow and rotation. So maybe I grow more peas, or beans, or lupins, or alfalfa, or clovers. And you pick those based on how much time you have. So that's like giving it a fallow and boosting the ground up, too.
Sure. Now, here, it is my understanding that rhizobial bacteria don't persist really well in our soils.
Yes.
Is that your understanding, too?
Yes. And so, in non-native plants especially, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what's our best strategy for increasing that nitrogen-fixing capability for legumes?
So the best strategy is to go look for the healthiest, biggest, fattiest plant in your plant population of whatever it is you just grew. Whatever species of legume you grew, you look for the one that is the most vigorous, or the group of them, and then look in the root zone, because you will find that typically those that are most vigorous also have the greatest colonization by these little bacteria that help them grow, which are known as rhizobium, which is just Latin for root, rhizo, and a bacteria, rhizobium bacteria. So they grow in relationship with that plant. So you find the healthiest one you can. That's first thing. wow, got big fatty nodules, and you look for pink ones, especially when you squeeze them. If they're not pink, then you don't have the best ones. If they're kind of creamy or yellow, they're not very vigorous nitrogen fixers. So you look for the healthiest, biggest population of these nodules on these roots that are, when you squish them, they actually look a little bit like meat. It's almost blood red color. Those are the ones that are the most efficient nitrogen fixers. Then you say, oh, great, I found a great population. There's a lot of them on these plants. Now, those bacteria have adapted to your site. They're, in fact, happy campers. The plants that are growing kind of wimpy or only have a few nodules on them, those aren't such happy campers. But the ones that you find, that plant's growing really well, or a group of plants, that right there, now you have these bacteria, and they're living on the roots, and they're living in the soil. You can see them on the roots because they've formed a nodule. They get visible, but there's more bacteria living around. So what you want to do is save those roots and a little bit of the soil, and you can do it simplest by just mixing it with molasses, equal parts. You can mix it with dry molasses. Any kind of sugar actually will do it. That feeds them carbohydrate, and you can keep it. So then you harvest that bacteria. You put them, mix them equal parts with some form of sugars, and they're stable. And then next time you plant, you use that bacteria for the next generation of seeds of the same species.
Mm.
And then you keep doing that. And over years, you will develop a strain that's specific to your site. And then they will stay and colonize. You won't have to keep doing that.
Mm.
That's how you do it.
Very cool. I was waiting for that sugar piece because I was like, okay, you've got it, but how are they going to continue to live? And then it's
sugar.
Like, it's the Korean natural farming mindset of like, give it some sugar, stick it in a jar, and it's going to live.
It'll be fine. I mean, can't keep it there for years and years, but,
okay.
You know, for 6 months or a year, it'll be stable.
Right.
And then plant that same, whatever it is. You want to plant beans again? Then. But again, remember that bacteria are specific to their species, so you can't mix up a lupin and an alfalfa and a bean. They all have their own. So if you don't have those to start with, then you purchase some of that inoculum, which is laboratory grown to be sort of universally adaptable, and you get it started, and then you look for the best ones in your population, and then you go from there, and then you have the most strongest.
Awesome.
Most strongest, is that a term?
It is now. So if we could jump over to sanitation as a concept.
Yes.
And I really hear, you know, one side and the other about how important it is to clean your plants and remove every leaf that's sort of past its prime, and don't leave leaves in the pathway for insects that may target that particular species or disease even.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hear from other people that it makes absolutely no difference, and they throw their leaves in the pathway and they never have a problem. What
yeah.
do you think?
You know, the wonderful thing about growing stuff is if we went to 20 broccoli growers today, we'd get 20 different answers to that question, because everyone has their own perspective and their own experience based that forms their perspective. And I have seen both extremes. The complete people picking off every little tiny leaf to the nth degree, to people doing absolutely nothing. I would say it's someplace in the middle. And I say that moderation is what we usually learn in most of life. The extreme in either direction probably ends up kicking you. So what I have learned, for example, if you leave a lot of vegetation laying around, certain kinds of creepy crawlies like that. So do you have problems with slugs or snails or earwigs or sow bugs? Well, then I would wonder, if I left a lot of stuff laying around the beds that was decomposing, that'd provide a good environment for them to live in. Once they fed on that and were hot hidden by that, then they're going to feed on your plant tissue. Now, do you need to take every single thing out? Probably not. However, if you see something that's really severely diseased, don't keep that around. A plant that's showing its symptoms, it's kind of like an indicator, like, ooh, good, I see this now, let's get it out of here.
Right.
Because oftentimes that can be vectored by the wind, by the slugs, by the aphid, by the whitefly. They can move these diseases from plant to
right.
plant. So if we catch that early on, say, that doesn't look healthy. Okay, that plant, to me, comes out.
Right.
That plant's going to cause a reservoir. Or another example, aphids. Oh, I see a lot of aphids on this plant. I might sacrifice that plant
right.
in order to reduce the reservoir for the rest of the field.
Right.
So I don't think it's do nothing, because then you can risk of everything getting moving. And on the other extreme, I think if you overdo it, then you spend way too much time analyzing how perfect everything has to be, and it's
right.
not a painting.
Right. And people interpret that idea of sacrificing the plant in two different ways. If it has an aphid pest, for instance, they'll say, oh, I'm sacrificing the plant by taking it out, or I'm sacrificing the plant by leaving it there because then they have a home and they'll leave the rest of the plants along.
I don't subscribe to the latter theory, and none of my farmer clients do either.
Okay.
And maybe that's because leaving something alone leaves it to the whims of nature, and us humans think we have to interact on some level. And so whether it's an organic farmer or not, or a gardener, we tend to actually take an action when we see a problem.
Right.
Now, they may be right. Maybe you just left it alone. The aphids would be happy and stay where they are, but I don't want them to multiply and become on other plants.
Right. And yet it's taken to a further extreme with a trap crop.
Yes.
At a distance to the primary crop.
And that may, in fact, be helpful as long as you keep an eye that in that trap crop you have something good there besides the pests. Because if they're just over there feeding on the trap crop and there's nothing eating them, they'll just build up in the trap crop and come back
move
to your
over.
Crop.
Well, that's funny that you say that because... often in my direct seeded crops, if I'm not really on top of it with thinning, for instance, and some aphids come around, what I notice first is the ladybugs.
Yeah.
And when I see 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 ladybugs, you know, one part of me is like, oh, cool, the ladybugs are here. The other part of me is like, uh-oh, where's the aphids?
Yeah.
Where are they? I know they're around, especially when I see larvae of ladybugs breeding, some eggs. I go, okay, where are the aphids? And it makes me happy, actually, that I practice not spraying things on the plants, and I'll just go in there and remove or cull out stuff that's diseased.
I think for most gardeners, that's all they need. Rarely do they need to buy something. Most of what we need to do with pest control, we can do by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, very rarely. And every now and then something gets out of control, it might be useful. But for the average gardener, those things you buy, whether they're organic or not, are just sort of replacements for your own interaction. You being in your garden solves your problem. If you wait till it becomes a big problem, you need to run down to the store and buy something to kill it. Well, if you stick around your garden more, you'd... caught it when there was just a few aphids when you saw those ladybugs.
Correct.
That's all about the, you know, they do say the best fertilizer is the farmer's footsteps. It's true. You cannot replace the human part to grow crops.
Truly.
Passive farming doesn't really work.
Sure. It's a mutual experience that happens together. Well, sanitation has become so important. Here, you know, we're on an island situation, but so many new pests are coming in. I mean, probably every single day. And one that really hit us hard in the last couple of years is basil downy mildew.
And there's a sanitation value.
And that is definitely a sanitation process.
Because downy mildew grows up on basil and will spread from plant to plant.
To plant to plant.
That's right.
And so that in that case, we would want to remove all the diseased tissue from the plants. I mean, I have 2 basil plants right now that are growing really well. They're as recommended in the sunny, hot, windy, least humid spot in my garden,
right.
Treating them like firstborn children, you know, and literally any little leaf I see that's a little yellow, it's out of there.
Yes.
And it's away, as far away as possible. So there's certain plants just seem to require a little more love, especially when there's a pest around that's really taking them.
And so now what we all need to do is grow those out until we get healthy ones that resist it and save the seeds from those. And that's how all disease resistance is done, is by developing another generation. And over time, you eventually find a plant that's tolerant and then eventually resistant. You save those seeds, and soon you have one that doesn't get the new downy mildew.
We want to let listeners know you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio, and we have special guest in studio, amigo Bob Contisano, here to share some really great ideas for all of our organic farming endeavors here on Kauai. And if people are interested in speaking to you further, amigo Bob, do you want to give any sort of contact information out?
I'm sure. Just my email, because I really don't want to answer my phone.
That sounds great.
I'm kind of on vacation.
How about it?
But my email, sure. It's orgamigo, like as an organic, O-R-G-amigo, orgamigo@gmail. Happy to answer things by email.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, another topic when it comes to soil building and management that's really high on our list, and I know something you love to talk about too, is high quality, fully matured compost. So
you hooked me in here with that question on your text yesterday.
I did. I know it's a subject that's close to your heart. Yeah. I personally have learned over the last couple of years that if I really love my garden, I need to really love my compost pile.
Yeah.
They're just going hand in hand. I see it real clearly. Yeah. So.
Mm. I think, Robin, I think what you're saying there is the same thing as about getting in touch with your garden. So you see when your plants start to show up with the beetles, the ladybugs there to feed, clean up the aphids, that's your warning signal of, hey, I need to look around some more. The composting is similar. You can have a passive compost and get some level of soil out of it. However, if you put more time and intent into it, you get more in return. It's like your garden. I think it was kind of what you're saying. You know, this, you got, as you get better at gardening, you see more what you need to do, which gives you an opportunity to refine that and to have a higher level of success and feel good about what you're doing. That's true with all crops, and compost is a crop. And so, in fact, I would say that my friends who are actually commercial composters think they're farming a crop. They're farming microorganisms, really, but it's a crop. And actually, all the things we're growing, we're farming microorganisms, too. We may think of we're growing broccoli or tomatoes or basil, but actually what we're doing is growing those bugs in the soil and above ground that keep the plant happy and growing. Compost is similar that way. It's an environment that creates a situation for the growth or not growth of microorganisms that do the process of taking the organic material, that's all that refuse you find all over, whether it was the diseased, you know, downy mildew-ridden basil or lawn clippings or the leftovers from your kitchen food wastes. All of these are organic material that need to go through a digestion breakdown and build-up phase through biology, microorganisms. Earthworms are the largest of the organisms that we see doing this. Actually, there's others, but I think people, so there's kind of a couple different versions. There's the worm castings, worms breaking down materials. Turns out once the worms break them down, then other microorganisms attack that stuff too. So it isn't just the worms. It's kind of a hybrid inside those worm piles. And then there's the more heat-active compost piles that break down under a greater temperature, which is more biology, more aerobic bacteria and fungi growing. That breakdown process, that heat that gets created, is simply the respiratory and growth phase of these microbes. And what are they doing? They're tearing apart all that organic material, which plants can't use directly. They don't feed on that cocoa husk, or they don't feed on that banana peel. They feed on what through the bodies of the microbes that then get literally pooped out as what we call humus. This is the way plants feed. They feed after the microorganisms have chewed the material, have broken it down and built it back up. Mm-hmm. But this takes place. If you just throw stuff in a pile, we all know it breaks down. We see that. So you get biology working even in that environment where you do, that's completely passive. And that makes something much better than just the raw materials, no doubt. However, what we've learned is with composting, you can manipulate that. Just like you want to get a raised bed to get more productivity, or you want to use an improved variety, or you want to have more fertility, all of those come with a decision that I'm going to manage these better for an end result for me and hopefully my garden as well. So with composting, if you take a more proactive approach to it, okay, I want to mix it up well. I want to make sure I get enough carbon and nitrogen, that's the green leafy stuff, and the carbonaceous rich materials and the manures and a mixture of as many different kinds of plant materials in there as I can find. We're going to need a pile that's big enough because in order to get temperature and get the biology happy, it needs to kind of be insulated from the outside atmosphere. So we'd like to get to like a 4 by 4 foot area as a minimum to get a good sized pile. Needs to be 3 or 4 feet tall in order to get enough insulation effect. It needs air, so when you build it, you make a lot of air in there, and it needs moisture because these microbes need moisture to eat, colonize, find something else, multiply, and they're multiplying by the minute, and dying by the hour. We have this tremendous amount of biology growing in an active compost pile in one heaping teaspoon. We've so far measured, the highest ever was 1.7 billion living organisms in a teaspoon in a compost pile. 1.7 billion. And that's just for that moment. It changes in an hour. We measure to be different because these things are all living and dying, and they're breaking down, and they're releasing nutrients, and they're breaking down organic material, and they're making humus and humic acids and fulvic acids and olic acids and carbonic acids and exchanging nutrients. All this is going on, and we are just managing the environment by keeping them with some air and water. They do it all for you. We don't even need to know why and how what all those terms mean. So all we need to do is manage the moisture, the air, and the mixture of materials. And if we manage, and so what happens when the biology gets really going, you get temperature hot, 130, 140 degrees. That means your biology is really working. That's too hot to put your arm in. It's working. And then you add some air and water to keep it happy. And then you make really rich, finished compost, and your garden gets better, right?
Yes.
That's what you're seeing. So the more we spend on this effort, it doesn't tremendous amount. You don't have to spend days and days on it. You know, you spend a couple hours a week on your compost pile, not even maybe an hour. You can make a much, much better compost that will be much richer on site, bring them more biology, more humus, more humic acids, more nutrients, happier plants.
Wow, what a beautiful manifesto that was.
Yeah, makes it sound so easy.
It really isn't easy, but it's not hard.
It sounds like what you're describing is not the most intensive process of checking the temperature and turning it so many times.
Yeah.
Once it hits a certain temperature, you flip it.
I mean, to maximize and speed up the process, then you take that much more detail. You make sure you monitor the temperature. You flip it as soon as the temperature drops down a little bit. That's awesome. That'll speed up. You'll get a quicker material. For most gardeners, that's not necessary. Just make sure it stays hot and keep it aerated and keep it moist. Don't let it get too wet in a rainstorm.
Right,
put
a
tent over it so it doesn't drown. But don't put a plastic bag over it so it smothers. It's a living thing.
Right on.
Yeah. I mean, so someplace between doing nothing and doing the max. We're talking about moderation in this process.
Right on. And for those of us who don't seem to have enough sort of kitchen scraps, vegetable scraps, or even fruit scraps to throw in, and I'm looking for alternative materials that have a really low carbon to nitrogen ratio, yeah?
Fresh green. Whatever you can find that's fresh green. So people spend an inordinate amount of time in here mowing grass and just leaving it in place. Grass would be an easy one. Straw, hay, anything that's fresh and green is going to have high nitrogen, low carbon, and easy to compost. Fresh leaves, all the stuff that gets left over from all the kitchens around here. Tremendous resource in just the restaurants that are around here. You know, coffee grounds. I can think of a whole bunch of things here that traditionally don't get utilized very much or not very well. So I would become a scrounge for what's going to waste in the hood. And you'll find a lot.
Awesome. Well, it sure has been a quick hour. We want to give thanks for the precious time that we've had with our dear friend Amigo Bob.
Thank you.
Here on island for a short time, but available to the world. As time goes on, we'll hope that he will continue to make Kauai his regular stopping place or place to recharge, re-energize, and get re-inspired by the beauty of our beautiful garden island. Robin and I want to thank everybody again who donated during the fund drive. Your generosity is keeping us going, and we're excited to be delving into some new topics with the new month arising. We do want to let you know that the Lahaina noon is actually coming up this Monday, the 31st, around 12:30 p.m. That will be the time that the sun is at the exact zenith directly overhead, a special phenomenon that only occurs here in the tropics. So check it out. And anything else from you, Robin?
A rare moment indeed when there's no shadow at all.
Indeed.
Well, this has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul, and we'd like to thank Amigo. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today. And please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.
Change a thing at all. While I'm gone, please don't change a thing. we're going somewhere.